So imagine this headline, transnational corporations taken on by small startup. And then in the little byline underneath it, David and Goliath story. Right? That, I mean, that's the line that's used oftentimes. We hear these stories, or it's a movie, or it's a David and Goliath story. You know, you can talk to almost anybody in the culture, and they know this story. It's one of those stories that goes beyond children's books and goes beyond churches, and it's just integrated in the culture, and people understand it, and they know what it is. When I was a kid, I grew up on this story, and I grew up on it in Sunday school. I grew up reading it in children's Bibles, and I don't know, you know, I've read through the Bible a few different times, and I've come across the story, but I don't know if I've really paid that much attention to the details before. And so as we head into this series, I want to read you the story. It's much longer than you probably remember it if you haven't read it lately. I'm going to read like 51 verses of it this morning. That's not even the whole story, but it's a bunch of it. And so if you want to follow along, you can in your Bibles, or you can just listen. And what I want you to do is I want you to imagine some of the things that you hear. I want you to ask yourself, what do I see? What do I smell? What do I feel if I'm there? I want you to maybe imagine what the characters in the story are feeling or thinking as best you can. Okay, this is from 1 Samuel chapter 17. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Soko and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. Now, the Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with a valley between them. If you were here last week, Tanner talked about this. It's kind of a stalemate. They're on two sides. There's a hill here and a hill here, and there's a valley in between. And nobody wants to go down because you give up the high ground, okay? That's the picture. They're in a stalemate. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span, which was like over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects, but if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." If you weren't here last week, one of the things Tanner talked about is they would often send someone into battle, and the two would battle so that they would avoid tons of bloodshed. So that's kind of what Goliath is doing here, is saying, come on, bring it on. He's taunting them. Send somebody down. Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now Saul's already been mentioned twice. You're the armies of Saul. Saul and the Israelites are dismayed and terrified. Saul was the natural person to fight Goliath, which we'll come back to. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time, he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines." So David's at home, he's taking care of the sheep, and he's the runner. Okay, so he's going to run cheese and bread and and everything else, and he's going to run a message back. Early in the morning, David left the flock in the care of a shepherd, loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine, champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel. So you get paid really well, you get the daughter of the king's hand in marriage, and you don't have to pay taxes for the rest of your life. Pretty good deal, right? That's what Saul wants to give. But nobody steps forward. David asked the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? They repeated to him what they had been saying and told them, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. That's the wealth, the daughter, the taxes. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom do you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now what have I done? Asked David. Can't I even speak? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of the Philistines. Your servant will go fight him. And Saul replied, you are not able to go against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried to walk around because he was not used to them. I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 smooth stones from the stream and put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag. With his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked at David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and now give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there's a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. That's the story. There's more to it. And you can read the rest of it, 1 Samuel 17. We'll dig into more of it we're spending 5 weeks on this. So the next 3 weeks, we'll continue to talk about this in this series called Giants. Because, again, this is a cultural story because we know that there are giants in our lives. We know that we face those giants. And let's face it, there's all these stories, right? Whether it's transnational corporations or it's some giant that you're facing in your personal life. I want to share with you this morning one of my favorite giants. He looks like this. Do you remember Andre the Giant? I remember when he was wrestling when I was a kid. And then one of my favorite movies that he was in, The Princess Bride. Who loves that movie, right? Great movie. I almost showed you a clip this morning, but, then we'll just digress. But Andre the Giant, this big, sort of gentle giant, but he's got a lot of strength in him. There are real giants, though, in our lives. Not the kind of ones of TV. We know that the giants in our lives aren't as easily destroyed as Goliath in this story. And we love the underdog, which is why we love this story, right? Tanner talked a little bit about this last week. We love the underdog, the one who comes against the giants. And this is one of my favorite superheroes, Underdog. Does anybody remember Underdog? Okay. I used to watch this when I was a kid, a little cartoon. It's Underdog. We love the underdog, right? Because the underdog is going to win against the big Goliath. He's going to come against, you know, anybody see the movie Aaron Brockovich? Okay, that sticks in my mind from when I was younger. It's, you know, she's coming against this major corporation and she's, you know, she's going to win. But as I get a little bit older, I wonder, like, is this story even true? And I don't mean the biblical story, like, did this happen with David and Goliath? But is the story about the underdog and the giants really true? It's really not what I experience that often, at least in the world that we live in. You know, as I look around the world, who is it that's winning? Is it the underdogs? Is it the underdog or is it the billionaire who's winning in our world today? Is it the mom and pop shop or is it the mega corporation that's winning in our world today? Is it the beautiful people who win or is it us normal folk? Right? Do the underdogs win in our world? Well, we want to keep telling ourselves that, right? We want to tell ourselves the story. We want to inspire. You know, we want to watch the movie about it because we want to believe that the underdog wins. But does the underdog win? I think that's one of the reasons we love this story. Let me go back a little bit to Tanner's message last week, just to recap, if you weren't here, remind you if you were. He talked to us about the importance of this battle for Israel. This was a turning point in Israel's history. And there's a lot of important things happening in this battle in terms of history. One of the things that Tanner talked about that just hit me like a ton of bricks, as he said, fear is like a magnifying glass. Fear is like a magnifying glass. Objects appear bigger than they are, right? When you're afraid, the giant looks even bigger than it really is. Tanner and I are both studying the brain for whatever reason because we're nerds, but he talked to you about the amygdala last week and how when your brain flips to your amygdala and you respond out of fear, you do all kinds of crazy things and things look scarier than they really are. Fear is like a magnifying glass. And even Jesus was afraid, right? Tanner shared that with us last night. Jesus, as he goes to the cross, Jesus is afraid. He's facing the giants. And if you think about that story, you think about the human story of Jesus, who wins that story? Well, we know the end of the story, right? But Jesus is crucified. The giants win in that story. Rome wins. The Sanhedrin wins. Jesus is the one who's crucified. The disciples are the ones who are scattered. Tanner talked about how David was small and Saul was tall. And Saul's supposed to fight the giant, right? Because he's the king and he's the tall one. But he bribes others to do it. And this little kid comes and he's like, fine, whatever, you can go. No sweat off my back, you know? You go face the giant, you'll die. I'll stay alive, I'll be fine. Whatever it is your fear, this was really helpful for me that Tanner said, whatever your fear is your God bigger than your fear? Because here's the truth, it depends what we focus on, right? What or who we focus on matters, because if fear is a magnifying glass, if fear magnifies the giants, it matters what we focus on, right? I love what Tanner shared last week about focusing less on the giant and more on who God is. And it kind of came, you know, as I thought about that, here's kind of what I thought is that when you focus on fear, the giant gets bigger and hope gets smaller, right? Are you with me? When you focus on your fear, the giant gets bigger and your hope gets smaller. But when you focus on God, the giant gets smaller and your hope gets bigger. Right? It's kind of like a weird math equation. Somebody write that out for me who understands math. It's like an inverse relationship or something, right? When you focus on the giant, your fear gets bigger and your hope gets smaller. But when you focus on God, the giant gets smaller and your hope gets bigger. And so the challenge that Tanner left us with last week is, what if we focused on God? What if we stop focusing on ourselves and our own fear and on the giant and the magnifying glass was on God? How would we approach, if you think about David, where was he focusing? It wasn't on the giant. In fact, if you walk through the story, the things that David says are so contrary to everything else in the story. It almost feels like it doesn't fit because he sees everything from a very different perspective. Well, who is this guy? And how come he's doing this? What's wrong with you guys? How come you're afraid? Isn't anybody going to step up to this guy? Are we going to really let him say those things about us? Are we going to let him say those things about our God? And you think, who is this little guy? There are all kinds of giants in life, right? Hopefully, since last week, you've been thinking a little bit about those. Or maybe just last week when you're here, you began to think about the giants in your life. Maybe it's a marriage that isn't turning out the way that you expected that it was going to turn out. Maybe it's a health issue that you've been dealing with or a family member or a friend is dealing with. Maybe you lost your job and it's finding a job or it's facing the job that you have that you hate. Maybe that's your giant. What is your giant this morning? Maybe it's an addiction. We're here in church this morning, right? But don't fool yourself to think that there aren't people sitting in this room who are dealing with addictions. Maybe you're facing the giant of addiction. Maybe it's mental illness. Maybe you've been dealing with mental illness all your life, or something has happened and your brain has changed and you're all of a sudden dealing with something. Maybe someone in your family is and you don't know how to face this change in your life. Or how about this? Anybody have any difficult relationships in their life? Anybody? Family members, friends, parents, siblings, kids? Maybe your giant is some secret sins that you haven't been able to face and you don't know how to face. Maybe the giant for you is losing weight and you've been going after that all your life and you can't beat that giant. Or maybe it's the negative self-talk in your head and that giant just keeps showing up and the fear rises in you. I don't know about you, when I face these things, the fear rises and the magnifying glass comes out and I find myself being like Saul and like the soldiers and backing off. Well, I want to do two things this morning. I want to look at two things with you if we have the time. I want to look at valleys this morning, and I want to look at the giants inside of us. Now, I asked you to listen to the story for this reason, because years ago, someone was talking me through the story of Jesus at the well with the woman in the well. And he was talking me through that story, and he said, I want you not to read it, I want you to just listen, and I want you to put yourself there as an observer. And I want you to tell me what you see. What do you see? And he would stop occasionally. He asked me what I'd see. And then he would say, well, what do you smell? What do you hear? And I found myself kind of transported into this place and imagining actually being there. And then he led me to a place of asking me to be one of the disciples who was there. And what I was saying and hearing from the other disciples as we talked, and what that experience of that moment was. And it made me realize that there's a different way to read the Bible. Because when I read this story, I immediately think about David. And I think I was taught to do this, right? Because when I read my children's Bible when I was in Sunday school, it's all about David, and I'm David, right? And so I've got to think about facing my giant, and I've got to be David. Well, here's what I want you to wrestle with in this story. I don't think you're David in the story. Or you might not be David. Or maybe it's helpful to think about yourself as not David in this story. In fact, in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about that piece really, really carefully and closely, and I really want you to be a part of that. But this morning, I want you to think a little bit about some of the other things in the story. And so we're going to look at the valley piece of this. What's the geography of this, and how might that speak to us this morning? And then I also want to look at a couple of characters and talk about the stuff that's going on inside. We will talk about David and about some of the things going on inside him as well. But I want to first start with valleys. We all face valleys in our lives, right? We all face valleys. This story takes place in a valley. There's hills and there's a valley. And there are these sort of mountaintop experiences that we have in life. We all have mountaintop experiences. But my experience has been, in watching other people, is that a lot less happens on the mountains and a lot more happens in the valleys. In fact, it's in the valley where some of the greatest battles are fought. So I want to show you a map a minute where this happens and why this is an important valley. And I have a laser pointer, which I've never used before. This will be fun. I've always wanted to do this, so you're my guinea pigs. So this is Jerusalem right here. And if you were to go a little bit south of here and over a little bit is where the Valley of Elah is, where this battle takes place. And you'll notice these are all trade routes, okay, that are going across here. This is the Mediterranean Sea, And if you come off the sea, like any ocean or along the lake, there's like this area right here which is really low, and next to that is plains, and then this is all mountains along here. This area in between is called the Shephelah, okay? The Shephelah. And the Shephelah is this area between the Mediterranean Sea and the mountains, and it's a really important area because you can actually travel on it. If you've been through the mountains, you know how difficult it is to get through the mountains. You have switchbacks, and it's dangerous. And the Shephelah became this place where you could actually travel. And so these trade routes, so you see this trade route coming down from here? See this trade route here? This trade route, and then coming around this way, is the way to Egypt. You see Egypt here? If you go up this way, you get up to Rome and to Greece over here. Over here is Samaria. And then if you head over to the east this way, you have India and China and all of that where the wise men came from, right? From the east. The reason that Israel and Palestine is such an important place is it's the crossroads of the ancient world. Palestine is the crossroads of the ancient world. It's where Greece and Rome and Syria and the East and Egypt all came together. Why did Rome care so much about Jerusalem and the Jews and what was happening in Palestine? Why did Babylon take over this area? Why did Syria take over this area? Because it's a really important area. And the Valley of Elah, and there are several valleys that sit in here in the Shephelah, those became major battlegrounds in the life of the ancient world, because if you own the valley, you own the trade route. If you own the valley, you manage the trade route. And there's taxes and there's finances and all those things that happen. And historically, these valleys were turning points. In fact, this battle with the Philistines becomes a turning point in the life of the history of the Israelites. David ends up becoming king, as we know, and they end up taking Jerusalem later, and they become the leaders of this area. This is a turning point because what happens in the valley is a turning point. Valleys are turning points. Valleys are turning points in the battle, not only in a war, but in the battle of your and my life. Why is that? Well, a couple things. When you're in a valley, so think about the valleys that you've been through in your life or that somebody you know has been through in your life. One of the things that happens in the valley is that true character comes out, right? Think of this story. Saul, king, tall, slays his thousands. What comes out in Saul's character in the story? He's actually a coward who's afraid, who's going to bribe somebody else to fight. True character comes out in the middle of the battle. What about David? His character comes out in this story, right? He's actually much stronger than he looks because he's just this little boy, but his character comes out. And the battle in the valley is not guaranteed, but it's a turning point. Things change when we come through the valleys. Valleys are key turning points in the battles of life. If you think back on the life that you've lived, there have been probably these major valleys that you've hit that have become turning points for you. The second thing about a valley is that they're fertile places of growth. I want to show you a picture a minute of the Shephelah. Actually, this is the Elah Valley where this battle is fought. Those are the two hills that they were lining up on, and Goliath and David would have fought down in the middle somewhere. Now notice this. Notice how green it is down in the valley. It's green in the valley because the waters go down. And so this becomes not only a place of where battles are fought, but it's a place of great agriculture as well. It's a place of travel, a place of agriculture, and it's a place of bounty and beauty. These are some of the most beautiful places in this hot, arid, desert-like area is in these valleys. The metaphor is in the valleys that some of the most beautiful things happen in our lives. They may be some of the most dangerous battlegrounds. They may be the place where we face our giants. They may be important places of turning points, but they're also some of the places where some of the greatest beauty grows. At the first service, I ran into a friend of mine that I've known for years. I have not seen him in several years. His wife died of cancer about 4 years ago. He just recently got married again, and we were just talking about the valley that he went through with his wife's cancer and her passing away. And what life is like now, and it's a whole new journey, right? There's this life before this valley and this life after this valley, and it was a turning point in his life in a lot of different ways. These valleys are important parts of our journey. They're important in our stories, and they become this fertile ground if we allow them to be fertile ground where beautiful things grow. So I wonder this morning, as you think about valleys in life, you think about the valleys, maybe you're standing on the precipice of a battle and there's a valley and you don't want to enter into it because you know it's going to be a valley. Maybe you don't want to enter into it because you know it'll bring some things out in your character that you don't want to be seen. Maybe you don't want to enter it because you know that it'll raise some fears in you and you don't know how to deal with that. I wonder this morning, is there a valley that you're hiding from? Because maybe there's a giant in the valley and you're afraid of it. I want to go back to David a minute here. David goes into this battle. We know the story. David wins. And David becomes king and all these things happen. Often when I go to the hospital, I think specifically of the hospital or go to someone's home when someone's at the end of life, and I'll ask, is there a specific scripture that you'd like me to read for you? Do you know what 90% of the time that scripture is? Take a guess. Psalm 23, right? Psalm 23, which is a great psalm, and you know, I'll read that. Do you know who wrote Psalm 23? David wrote it. Now, we don't know exactly when David wrote it, but I want to read it to you this morning. This is from the NIRV. It's a New International Reader's Version. It's very similar to the NIV. The Lord is my shepherd. Okay, just think of the first part of this, right? Who's the shepherd in our story? David. He leaves the inheritance. He leaves the sheep to go do this thing. The Lord is my shepherd. He gives me everything I need. He lets me lie down in fields of green grass. In Palestine, where do you find green grass? In the valleys, right? Where the water is. Which is the next line. He leads me beside quiet waters. Where do we find quiet waters in Palestine? In the desert. In the valley. He gives me new strength. He guides me in the right paths for the honor of his name. Whose name is being dishonored in our story today? It's God's, right? David says that you're dishonoring the name of the Lord. Even though I walk through the darkest, what? Valley, I will not be afraid. You are with me. Your shepherd's rod and staff, they come from me. Okay, did you listen to the story when I read you the story? When David goes into the valley, what does he take with him? Before he picks up the stones, what does he take with him? Did you catch it? A staff. What kind of staff does a shepherd take with him? Shepherd's staff, right? Your shepherd's rod and staff comfort me. You prepare a feast before me right in front of my enemies. You pour oil on my head. My cup runs over. By the way, oil over the head is a picture of the anointing that would happen when the king is anointed. David, this is probably the turning point at which Saul loses his kingship and David begins his kingship in a lot of ways, right? I am sure that your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life and I will live in the house of the Lord forever. I wonder when David wrote this psalm. Part of me wonders if, like David, you know, it's kind of gross, but he's carrying the head of Goliath. And I wonder if he kind of goes and sits up on the top of the mountain, sets the head down and pulls out his journal and writes some poetry. It's a little gross, I know. But I wonder, I mean, this story, we don't know it was written here, but certainly David has this experience, right? God, I went into the valley and you were there and you gave me strength and you walked me along the water and you kept me safe and right in front of my enemies and my cup overflows. What's the valley before you? What's the valley before you? Do you trust God enough to go down into the valley? So let me tell you about, anybody ever been to Banff in Canada? Okay, it's a beautiful place. My wife and I were there for our honeymoon years ago. And we had just gotten married and we're walking downtown Banff and we had one of these kind of tragic moments where an older gentleman fell to the ground as we were walking along the street and his wife, you know, as any of us would, kind of lost it, and she's crying and hysterical and asking for help, and some people gathered around, and I had just taken CPR that summer, and my new bride was like, save him, you know? And you know, me being the man that I am, I was like, no. I don't know how, and I didn't pay attention in the class, and you know, all these things are going in my mind. Like I don't remember. I don't know how to count. I'm going to get it wrong. And then somebody's going to sue me, and it's Canada. I'm an American. They're probably going to throw me in jail, and they're going to, you know, fear is a magnifying glass, right? It was a moment of fear for me because all of a sudden, all this stuff inside of me, right? All this, am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Can I do this? And I'm with my new bride, and it's in public, and all those things happen. And I said, no, someone will help him, and we walked past. And I regret that moment. I've always regretted that moment, but that was a moment where I had to face some giants, right? So this story uses this language for Goliath. It says that he's the champion, and the Hebrew word for the champion means the one who stands in the gap. So Goliath is standing in the gap for the Philistines and saying, who's going to stand in the gap from your side? Who's going to step up, right? Who's going to stand in the gap for everybody else? Well, we know, what's the answer to that question for Israel? It's Saul. Right? Saul's the king. Not only that, there are some other reasons that make Saul the one who would stand in the gap. Let me read you a couple passages. This is from 1 Samuel chapter 9, and it's about Saul. It's the first time he comes up. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, okay, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechereth, the son of Aphiah of Benjamin. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome as a young man as it could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. You know, this is like tall, dark, handsome guy, you know, and he's probably buff too. You know, this is the guy I didn't like in high school. He's the man, you know, he's strong, he's tall, he's good looking, he's a man of standing, he's from a good family. He's the chosen choice. He's the one that should stand in the gap. When Goliath says, who's going to stand in the gap? It should be Saul that steps in. He's the military champion. Two giants against each other. It also says that Saul was a Benjamite. Now, why does that matter? Well, if you remember or don't know, there were 12 different tribes in Israel. Benjamin was one of those tribes. Benjamin was the smallest tribe. They had the smallest geographical area. They had the smallest number of people. But like one of my best friends in high school who was the shortest guy, he was the toughest, right? He was scrappy, and he would, you know, that's kind of how the Benjamites are. Here's how Judges talks about the Benjamites. This isn't a battle between tribes of Israel, so kind of a battle between brothers almost. But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 able men from those living in Gibeah. You know, they're like, we're small, but we all fight. You know, we're all coming out against you. Saul comes from that group, right? Saul's the tall guy in the little country of the little guys who get up and fight. But there's more. This is also from Judges. Listen to this. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 select troops who were left-handed. Anybody left-handed here? A couple of you? Okay. Each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. You catching that? Could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin has some select troops. Those select troops are what? Stone throwers. In our story, who's the stone thrower? It's David, right? Who should be the stone thrower? More than likely, we don't know this for sure, but more than likely, Saul was a select troopsman who slung stones. And yet David, a shepherd who carries a staff, does what Saul should do. Let me ask you this question. Why didn't Saul step forward? Why didn't Saul step forward? He's a big guy. He's a select troop. Troopsman, he's got the special skill probably. He's the king. Why doesn't he step forward? Is it possible that he didn't step forward for the same reason that I didn't step forward on that sidewalk in Banff that day? Is it possible that this big guy who was the king of this army actually had all these insecurities inside of him? I wonder, was there a giant inside of Saul that he was unable to face? I wonder this morning, do you have any giants inside of you that you're afraid to face? Maybe the giant isn't Goliath in the story. What about all these guys who are sitting on the hill, all these troops? How come nobody goes forward? I wonder, is there a giant inside that we're all fighting, that we're afraid of, that's magnifying our fears? And in walks this little boy, younger boy, a shepherd boy named David, an unlikely hero. He's the unlikely hero in our story. In fact, he's the cheese and bread kid, right? He's the runner. He's just supposed to bring bread and cheese to his brothers. And his dad says, I want you to bring this cheese and bread, and then I want you to come back and bring assurance. And then Jesse says this to his son, David. He says this. This is 1 Samuel 17:19. He's talking about the brothers. They are with Saul, and what's the next three words? All the men of Israel in the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. Jesse just said this to David. Now, if I'm David, what did I just hear? Are you following me? All the men are on the battlefield. David, can you go bring them cheese? What did David just hear? You're not a man. You're a boy. You don't belong on the battlefield, but you can bring cheese and you can bring a message back. Now, if that's me, like that's already a giant inside. Dad doesn't believe I can fight. Right? So then David goes to the battle lines and he sees his brothers there, and his brother responds, look, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be home taking care of the sheep. Come on, get out of here. You don't belong here. So now dad doesn't believe in him. Brother doesn't believe in him. Now, if I'm David, I've got all these insecurities now inside of myself. David ends up talking to a couple guys and they send him to Saul, or Saul calls for him. And he says to Saul, Goliath is dishonoring the name of the Lord. I'll go fight him. And do you remember what Saul says? You can't go fight him. You're just a young man. And Goliath has been fighting since he was like your age. It's kind of what he says. Since he was a youth. You're a young man. He's been fighting since he was your age. You can't go up against this guy. Here's the interesting thing. Now, if that's me, and let's get a little personal here. I've got all these giants inside of me, and I think you probably do too. Insecurities, fears, wondering, am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Am I strong enough? Am I man enough? Am I Christian enough? Am I whatever enough? And the world continues to tell us, whether it's our fathers or our mothers or our brothers or our friends or the television or whatever it is, consistently telling us that we're not good enough, we're not good enough, we're not good enough, we're not good enough. Giants inside of us defeat us before we ever end up walking on the battlefield ourselves, because I'm just the cheese guy who brings the message. I can't step in here. And so what do? We stand as cowards on the battle lines and watch the name of the Lord be dishonored. So let me leave you with this this morning. I don't think the question is, how big are you? I don't think the question is, how big is your giant? Really don't. Don't think the question is, how small are you, or how small is your giant? How big are you? How big is your giant? The question is this: how big is your God? How big is your God? It's the same question that Tanner asked last week. How big is your God? Because if you're going down into that battlefield by yourself, the giant's really big, inside and outside. But if you're going down on that battlefield and the Lord Almighty is behind you, then there's nothing that can stand up against the Lord Almighty. The best example I can think of, it's like Mufasa and Simba. Do you remember this scene? Simba roars and Mufasa's behind him, right? And they flee. If God is behind you, it doesn't matter how big you are, or how small you are, or how beautiful you are, or how strong you are, or how weak you are. How big is your God, and who is your God? This week, as you step into this kind of towards the third week of our series, I want you to, a couple things. One, don't be afraid to face your valleys. We all have them. And so often we try to go around the valleys in life. But I want to encourage you that the valleys are the turning points in life. There were characters developed. There were beautiful things grow. But you have to go through them, not around them. And though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you need to fear no evil because God is with you. So what's the valley that you need to enter into that you've been avoiding? The second one is don't be afraid to face the giants inside. Be honest about them. What are they? What are the things you're afraid of? What are the voices in your head and in your heart that are keeping you from even thinking about stepping into the valley? And you can face those valleys and you can face the giant inside because you have a big God who's behind you and with you. So this week, what I want you to do is I'm going to give you some homework. This is your homework. In the morning, I want you to read Psalm 23. And at night, I want you to read Psalm 23. Maybe read it in some different versions. Maybe read it to each other. Maybe listen to it. Maybe you learned it as a child. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you memorized it this week. Read it in the morning. Read it in the evening and think about the valleys and the giants that you can face with God behind you. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that you are a God who does not leave us by ourselves. You don't leave us as orphans. You don't send us out onto the battlefield all alone. But God, you say that you are with us. Thank you for the words of David that your rod and your staff, they comfort us, that you prepare a table before us in the presence of our enemies. Thank you, God, that you bring victory. And that no matter what valley it is that we're facing, that no valley is deep enough and no giant is big enough that they can come against you. We think about Jesus Christ, your son, who faced true death and who hung on a cross and who faced all of sin and all of death and faced it with your strength and your power, and that you rose him again. Father, we believe in the resurrection. We believe in the life everlasting. We believe that the valley is not the end, but the valley is something we go through and that there's another side. Father, I pray that you would give us strength to believe that you're behind us and that you're with us. Give us the courage this week to step into the valley, to face the giants both inside and outside, knowing that you are the one who brings all power and that you have all authority in heaven and on earth. We pray that we would believe these things and live in the world you've given us with those strengths. Pray these things in the name and the power of Jesus Christ.